subgroups of the Washington Oregon State Commissions for Columbia River discussion. Welcome to everyone. Hope everyone's doing well. The first thing on here is introductions and open public comments. So I am Larry Carpenter, the chair of the Washington State Fish and Wildlife Commission. Will the Washington, my Washington colleagues introduce themselves, please? And then we can go to Mary Wall and the Oregon people.
Well, this is Barbara Baker. I'm the vice chair and happy to be with you on this nice day.
This is Jim Anderson, commissioner from Washington. I'm grateful to be here and looking forward to the meeting today. I do have some comments I could make a little bit later. So.
Okay. Well, yeah, please let me know, Jim, so I don't miss that. So I'll try to remember that. Commissioner McIsaac.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don McIsaac, commissioner up on the Hawkinson Hillside, looking at the prospects of 68 degrees out here today. And I also would have a few comments when we get to opening remarks.
Okay. Chair Wall, would you like to take the lead on the Oregon side? And we will get, I'd like to come back to the respective staffs too, once we get done with the commissioner introductions.
That sounds good. Thank you, Chair Carpenter. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us, including those tuning in electronically on the online option. I'm Mary Wall, Chair of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission, and I live on the south coast of Oregon. So we would go next then to Vice Chair Woolley.
Okay, I was muted there for a second. So thanks, Chair Wall. I'm Greg Woolley. I'm the Vice Chair of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission. I'm in the Portland metro area, which of course includes Portland and some areas to the east of there. And I'm just happy that our discussion is continuing and everybody is optimistic. And that's a good way to conduct communication.
Commissioner Zarnowitz.
Okay, I'm Jill Zarnowitz from the District 1, which is west of Commissioner Woolley's district, with the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. One just little piece of business here. I've had a couple of commissioners speak to me in the last week about requesting a 30-minute wrap-up at the end here so we can talk about next steps, scheduling going forward, et cetera. So I would ask people to say what they need to say, but in the spirit of trying to have a little more time at the end, try and work in that direction if possible. So anyone that wants to make opening comments before we go to staff introductions, or would you like to do staff introductions first?
Staff introductions first.
Okay. Washington staff introduction, please.
Hello, everybody. Kelly Suzuwin, Director, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. Happy to be here. Look forward to the conversation. I'll pass it over to Bill just to organize things.
Good morning, commissioners. Bill Twight here, Special Assistant for the Fish Program on Columbia River Issues. I see Craig Burley and Charlene Hurst, I think both of whom would go after me in some order.
Good afternoon, Craig Burley, Deputy Director of Fish Program.
And I'm Charlene Hurst, I'm the Columbia River Management Unit Lead. And I also see Joe Panesco on here. So I don't know if Joe wants to introduce himself.
Joe, your smiling face, Joe. I guess he doesn't want to. Are there any other staff from Washington that I'm not seeing? Okay. I guess Chair Wall will go to the Oregon staff.
Great. And we, of course, would start with Director Melcher, and he can then pass it on.
Thanks. Good morning. I'm Kurt Melcher. I'm the Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I'll hand it off to Cedric.
Good morning, everyone. Cedric Cooney, Acting Fish Division Administrator.
Good morning, everyone. This is Chris Kern, Deputy Fish Division Administrator for Columbia Marine Programs. I think I was probably next in line there. And so I'll hand it to, I believe, Tucker Jones is on, so he can introduce him.
Yeah, good morning, Chair Wall, Chair Carpenter, members of both commissions. Tucker Jones, I'm the Columbia River Ocean Salmon Program Manager for Oregon Fish and Wildlife. Happy to be here today. Also, I have John North is with us. And John, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. John North, Columbia River Fisheries Manager for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Does that wrap up the Oregon contingent, Kurt?
We do have our general counsel from DOJ, Annika Marriott, on the Zoom as well.
Okay, very good. Okay, if we could go back then to the Washington folks first for opening comments.
Hey, Chair, just a quick, my Zoom was temporarily frozen. Sorry, I'm Joe Pinesco. I'm Assistant Attorney General, Senior Counsel Advisor to the Fish and Wildlife Commission.
Thank you for joining us, Joe. We appreciate it. Okay, opening comments from the Washington contingent. I've made mine. I'll stand down and let others do it.
How about if I go? This is Jim Anderson. I want to thank the Oregon Commission and the Oregon staff, as well as the our department staff and fellow commissioners for the opportunity to come together today. I think it's real important that we have a good working relationship, and that's really critical as we move forward. Our natural resource issues are very complex. They're challenging. There's a lot of shades of gray, and there often is no real right or wrong. Many of these are intractable in some cases, and they can interfere with our management of the resource. I'm excited about engaging in these discussions. We've had a long history of the commissions coming together on common plans and policy on regulatory and implementation measures. And this past year and a half has been pretty unusual with COVID. And I think all of us are looking forward to moving past that. We have a lot in common. I think we're bound together in process through the compact and through USV Oregon, the Pacific Council, and all the different processes that we share. And so I know all of us care deeply about what it is we do and the resource and the people that we serve. So, I'm looking forward to having some more background discussions here and arrive at some common understandings with regard to the status of our Columbia River fish stocks, the trends, the patterns, our management processes, and the metrics so that we have this common platform as we move forward. We do have some differences as we have historically, and we're looking forward to talking those through. And I think Don will probably talk about the changes that we have had in the Columbia River fish policy. Some of those move us in probably different ways than where we have been with Oregon. But we think that our changes have some real improvements, and we look forward to talking about them. So I'll just close by saying I really am looking forward to hearing also from Oregon about the continued importance of the issues that you have. And I think that we can put together a common agenda as we move forward for this coming year. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Anderson. Vice Chair Baker, do you have any comments before I go to Commissioner McIsaac?
No, I'm going to, I'm firmly in listening mode right now, but I also share Jim's comments.
Thank you. Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks to Jim for those remarks too. Let me also thank everybody. March 31st got to be one of the busiest times of the year for everybody, so thanks for everybody coming to hear I also probably need to apologize in advance. My internet connections can get poor here, and if I fade out, my apologies for that. So this is the third meeting of our commissioner delegations to discuss joint state Columbia River policy and regulatory concurrency. The first one involved some pretty detailed Q&A on the Washington mechanics of the policy, but we did not get too far in that meeting on the why questions of discussing policy matters. The second focused on conservation background associated with our policy choices, a very good meeting. And today we're hopeful to have some initial commissioner to commissioner policy discussions on some aspects of a concurrent approach in fishery management matters, as well as climate change that we did not get finished last time, and talk a little bit about our future business. So it's kind of a meeting associated with understanding, as Jim said, as opposed to not having any decision-making on matters of substance. Just to give you just a quick 1 minute maybe idea of what might be coming under agenda item number two, if I could ask Nikki to put that agenda back up there, just so we have an anticipation of what we might be looking at here. Nikki, can you do that?
I'm working, sorry.
Yep, there we go. Okay. So we have a presentation from some folks on the status of Columbia River fish runs, mostly looking at long-term runs. You'll hear that this is an aggregate of the big runs and that we might have a little discussion during that about overfishing in the Columbia River and if there's any pattern of that back through time. So these are some long-term trends of this kind of a thing. Under number 2B1, review of economic performance since 2012. I understand we'll have a nice short joint staff presentation of a couple of slides on that. And the intent of that would be just to give some background of the basis of the Washington Commission decision-making last September. That was a key thing in some of our considerations. Under 2B, the last one there, provisions overview. This follows up a little bit where we ended at the end of the last meeting in terms of looking a little more closely at some parts of the Washington policy. At this point, I'm going to try to bring on screen control if I can get the internet to work and just try to make a few highlights. There's a half a dozen of them or so in there where I think we do have common ground. And Jim Anderson talked a little bit about that. I think we've got a lot of common ground based on our last meeting. And so it would just be a discussion to initiate some discussion on what hopefully at some point down the road could be a joint state policy and regulatory concurrence. So that's a little preview of what's coming, Mr. Chairman, and that's all I've got.
Thank you, Commissioner McIsaac. Okay, if there's no objection, Nikki, take down the agenda again. Thank you. Chair Wall and you and your colleagues have any opening comments?
Well, I will say a few things first, if I could, and then, of course, give Commissioner Woolley and Commissioner Zarnowitz a chance if they would also like to say a few things. I, like others who have already spoken, feel like this is an important discussion that we're having. It's an important working relationship, and it's a great chance for the two states to talk about these issues. One way to frame this, the Columbia River resource is like a bank account that we jointly manage and that has to last us long, long into the future. And we can, and I think we have had a lot of discussions about how to spend the resource, and we'll sure hear some more about that today, which I look forward to. We'll hear about that from both staff and our commission colleagues. We agreed collectively that we would like to pivot also to talk about the resource itself and how to make sure that that resource is resilient and productive into the future, and about how to make sure we have a bank account left before we revise how to spend it. Clearly, we're not going to reach historical levels, but there are millions of reasons to try, even in the face of climate change impacts, to increase the runs. I won't go into all of those. We don't have enough time, but we will get to those later, I think. The Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission has spoken about this issue several times and made it clear that they want us to be spending the resource, if you will, in the context of the status of that resource and in the context of improving the run. So they are very interested in us having that conversation about conservation of the resource. Any Oregon negotiations about the Oregon rules, of course, would have to go to the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission first and the Oregon public first, and then we would do that jointly with the Washington group. It's not appropriate for the three of us, of course, to negotiate the allocation, and I don't think anybody was suggesting it. I just want to make sure that you know that that's how we've been looking at it, and that we are very interested in having this joint conversation about the resource. So this chance, I think, is great. I have confidence that we will not squander this and we'll make good use of these conversations. So I'll stop there and see if we have any comments from either Commissioner Woolley or Czarnowitz.
I feel that Chair Wall covered us pretty well. And so I really don't have anything to add to that. I think I'd probably yield to Commissioner Czarnowitz. I'm happy that she's on board with us, and she has a lot of water resource background. And so I'm happy that she's gotten involved. So I'm just going to pass on that. Thank you, Chair Wall, for that summary. And we'll see if Commissioner Czarnowitz has a comment.
Thank you, Chair Wall. I didn't plan a comment on it, and I think you covered the Fish and Wildlife, Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission's goals very well. So I don't have any additional comments. And I appreciate the both Commissioner Anderson's and Commissioner McIsaac's comments as well.
Mr. McIsaac.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one follow-up I forgot to mention that goes along your time management ideas there. In agenda item two, we've got three things, and it might be that we take 30 minutes on each of those, but we would like to get to each of those. If the discussion gets long on the first one or the second one, we would like to try to make sure we get to all three of those and not postpone any of those to the next meeting. Thank you.
Well, I don't disagree with that. I just want to reiterate, I've been asked to try and provide 30 minutes at the end, so I'm just looking for everyone's help in achieving that. So we will go to agenda item two. This is a Washington presentation. Don and Jim, I expect, have the floor.
I think for the first one, the staff would have the floor. I don't have the agenda up in front of me here, but I think item number 2A is a matter of taking a look at the long-term trends. And again, we'll hear the staff talk about this being an aggregate of hatchery and wild and an aggregate of many different stocks. But the idea here is to take a look at the long-term trends and try to answer the questions of, are we looking at a long-term decline that we really need to deal with? Are we looking at long-term stability, or are we looking at over the long-term an increase in abundance? And it's a very general presentation, but I think I will ask Charlene Hurst to, I think she's prepared to put some slides up for us to look at.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner McIsaac. And good morning, Commissioners, Chair Wall, Chair Carpenter. Nikki, do you have the presentation to display on the screen?
I do.
Can you do that, please?
Sharing now.
And this is a presentation of about 10 figures. Probably take about 10 minutes or so to walk through this, and then we can certainly address any questions folks may have. Myself along with other joint state staff. So, oh, sorry, Nikki, it's the other one on Columbia River returns.
No problem. Let's see.
Sorry.
This guy, right?
Yes, thank you. So this first slide here is just a slide to help you visualize the timing of the runs for the various species of salmon and steelhead and shad that we have in the basin. There are three sort of peaks for Chinook. You can see in the spring season, spring Chinook, summer season, summer Chinook, and then in the fall season, we have that big fall Chinook peak. So I think this is just a sort of a summary slide to help folks visualize that. And next slide, Nikki, please. So this first slide is outside of the Columbia. We're going to Puget Sound just for the one slide. And this is, like Don mentioned, these are all presented as aggregates. This is the only sort of species in a geographic area that's presented with the hatchery wild breakout. So you can see that here, the hatchery fish are denoted in the dark blue and the wild fish in the light blue. And you can see a general decline looking in the light blue section of the graph over time in the wild Puget Sound Chinook returns. Next slide, please, Nikki. So going back into the Columbia River, we have our upriver spring Chinook returns. And we have a few metrics on each of the following slides. We have a 1970s average. We have a 2010s average. And we also have on there when each of these, when each of the ESUs or DPSs was actually listed. So most of those listings actually took place in the 1990s and the early 2000s. But as an aggregate, if you compare the 1970s average to the 2010s average, we have seen an increase in upriver spring Chinook over time. I'd say within the last 5 years or so, you can see we had a peak in 2015 and it dropped off, but it did trend up slightly over the last year. Next slide, please, Nikki. So this is the upper Columbia River summer Chinook return. Again, we have some various averages on here with a dip in the 1980s and then back up in the 2010s. Again, we had that sort of really high record return in 2015, some period of decline after that, and then back up in 2020. Next slide, please, Nikki. Here's our Columbia River sockeye returns. Again, just remembering this is an aggregate. So we did have the Snake River ESA listing in 1991. And if you compare the 1970s average to the 2010s average, we see quite an increase in Columbia River sockeye as a whole. So here's the Columbia River upriver summer steelhead return. And we have the A index in the lighter gray color and the B index in the darker gray color. In both cases, we see an increase compared to the 1970s average of these stocks over time. Of course, we've seen a little bit of a dip in these last few years with both the A index and the B index returns. Here's the Columbia River Fall Chinook return. We have a couple of listed ESUs included in this aggregate, the Snake River Fall ESA listing and the Lower Columbia River Fall ESA listing in the later 90s. Similar to the other graphs, we've seen an increase in the overall aggregate of Fall Chinook, almost a doubling from the 1970s average compared to the 2010s average. In the most recent 5 years, after the 2015 sort of record return, a few years where it trended back down and then back up in 2020. Next slide, please, Nikki. So this is breaking out the Fall Chinook into a few specific stocks, our Lower River Hatchery and our Upriver Brights. And we've seen a decrease actually in the Lower River Hatchery if you compare the 1980s average to the 2010s average. And those are in the green bars. And then for the upriver brights, we've seen almost a fourfold increase in that stock if you compare the two averages. And those are the ones denoted in blue. And from the graph, you can see the returns in 2020 were a bit higher for both stocks compared to the previous couple of years. Next slide, please. This one focuses on the Columbia River Snake River Wild Chinook return. And so we have an average from the mid 80s to the 90s of 1750. And then we've seen quite an increase in this stock if we look at the 2010s average. And This is, I think, in large part due to the Snake River Fall Chinook Hatchery Program that the Nez Perce and State of Idaho and other federal and private entities are managing. So, next slide, please. So on this next slide, we're looking at the coho return. We have the late part of the return denoted in the light blue and the early part of the return denoted in the dark blue. These were listed in the mid-2000s, and there's not a huge difference between the 1970s average and the 2010s average. This stock is pretty or this species is pretty variable in its returns, but we did see an uptick compared to the few previous years in 2020, and of course the forecast this year expected to be fairly large. So next slide, please, Nikki. Oh, never mind. These are just the detailed numbers for all of those figures, but we don't need to spend time on this piece. So anyway, happy to take questions if there are any, and welcome any other joint state staff to chime in on those answers. Thank you.
Mr. Zarnowitz.
So your first slide or two showed hatchery and wild, and then not that one, but the next color one. Yeah. The rest of them just lumped, did not indicate whether we're looking at hatchery or wild, and except for a couple of them. So I found the graphs a little confusing, because here's the one that you're showing right now, showing Chinook returns relative to hatchery and wild, and the others weren't clearly marked, or you didn't even talk about it unless I missed something in the beginning.
No, you didn't miss anything. They are the following figures. Well, this one in particular is also an aggregate, but it is broken out by hatchery stocks versus wild stocks. The ones for the Columbia are aggregate graphs of both wild and hatchery populations, as you mentioned, except for a few exceptions. So that is true.
Okay, because obviously the wild ones are the ones that are restricting the fisheries in the Columbia, and the ones also we're trying to make sure increase. So, but I understand your slides now. Thank you.
Chair Carpenter, it's Mary Wall, if I could just.
Sure, Chair Wall, please. Yep.
Yeah, I would just follow up Commissioner Zarnowitz's question with a bit of the same, to echo that since what constrains the management is the wild stocks, it's always useful to me to see those broken out so that we know what management decisions and questions are in front of us. I think that when there are upticks and when the hatchery numbers show an aggregate that is high like that, it's useful to have that. We should celebrate it in the streets when we get these upticks. At the same time, I know that we have constraints because of the wild stock. So it's always useful to me to get that realistic picture of what the wild stocks are doing as well. So I would sure look to that for when we come back to this with a recap next time.
Charlene, I have a question. This is Larry Carpenter. Are these graphs that you provided, are they jointly approved by both states? I'm assuming they are, but could you tell me, clarify that?
Yes, I think the data is jointly approved by both states. I would let the Oregon staff chime in if they disagree. But yeah, my impression is it's joint state data.
Oregon staff, would you like to comment on that?
Oh, well, Chair Carpenter, this is Chris Kern. Without going through the numbers, I don't know that any of us have done a line by line on this, but it certainly looks like the sorts of joint staff report information and things that we typically share and utilize. So I don't have any reason to say it's not, but I haven't tried to line by line compare it.
Okay, well, that's good enough for now. I wanted to get a clarification. Commissioner McKay, you had your hand up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A comment on the hatchery wild question at hand and what we would take away from these graphs, and then maybe a question on the fishing part of it. So, Nikki, if you could scroll back up to the previous graph that has the hatchery and wild for Puget Sound. I think the initial graph here's purpose is to take a look at just what is an obvious decline here? What seems to be a decline? We've heard a lot about Puget Sound returns being a decline. And if you look at that light blue line, it is on a declining pattern. And the ESA listings came along in the 1990 zone. And we just in Washington got a presentation a bit ago that showed that there were something like 30% down in recent years compared to when they were first listed. And so when you scroll to summer Chinook, it looks like my internet connection might be unstable here. Could you scroll to the summer Chinook one, Nikki? The next one after that, there we go. So in terms of looking at these aggregates, is there an obvious trend for decline, or is it stable, or is it increasing? And so when you look at the summer Chinook return, these are wild fish and some hatchery fish that are not listed. The wild fish are not listed. And for those of us who were around in the 70s and 80s, when the impacts of the four Snake River dams built in the mid 70s finally kicked in, that was a genuine decline from the 1971 period down through the 80s, and 20,000 a year seemed to be about it. And a lot of people thought that was going to be it for summer Chinook. They were going to just continue down and continue down to go extinct. But this is not a decline. And so I want to maybe echo what Chair Wall said. When we have good news, it's a good thing to celebrate. We should not overshadow that we do have some genuine conservation concerns here for the wild fish. And it's a mixed bag in there, but we do have some strong, genuine concerns. Nikki, if you scroll down to toward the end, there's one for Snake River wild. I think it's wild fish. Let's see, a little bit more. There we go. No, the purple one there. So this is one of those ones that is a piece of good news in both regards. Obviously, we don't see a declining trend here. We see something that's working out well. This is just wild fish. And so they are listed under the ESA, so this is a good thing. We could look at sockeye, which are also a good thing, but hidden inside of that is the Redfish Lake sockeye. And even though they're improving, they're still in very tenuous shape. So B-run steelhead, wild steelhead are obviously a huge conservation concern now. So I just want to make the point that while there's good news here, that's a good thing. While there are genuine conservation concerns, we do need to worry about that and do what we can. But it's not an overall picture of a terrible decline across all the runs, across all the species. And that's just something that we would keep in mind. The question of mine builds on Chair Wells' analogy in the economic realm about an investment and taking out interest that doesn't take out so much interest or principal so that you can't continue and sustain things. And so my question on this is the amount of fish. Start with that, but it's a general question. And Nikki, I think the sockeye is previous to this one. It's a red graph, as I recall. Let's see here. This is almost entirely wild fish here. There's a little bit of hatchery program in the Snake River Basin. But in terms of a question about fishing, and while we need to integrate the hydro system and habitat and hatchery business, are we taking too much out of the runs so that we are going to impair our ability to sustain further growth where it's appropriate and in fisheries? The question would go to Charlene and the joint staff there about whether we've had a pattern of overfishing, have we had a pattern of exceeding our conservation goals, and which of these runs are lightly fished and which of these runs are more moderately fished.
Yeah, well, I can take a first attempt stab at it and then invite other joint state staff to follow on. But I would say the first thing I would, you know, maybe draw people's attention to is we do all of our fisheries have ESA limits, impact limits on them, and we do rarely, if ever, exceed those. So we generally fish within the ESA constraints. We also have the ability to manage our fisheries in season adaptively as we get updates on, you know, the impacts that we've seen to date and also run size and, you know, improvements or modifications needed for the forecast. So those are, I guess, a couple of points that I would make in addition to what Don mentioned earlier about, you know, the hydro system, the habitat. I'd say, you know, some predation, many other things in the system, I think makes it difficult to kind of speak, you know, to have fishing impacts be isolated from some of the other interconnected parameters. And we'll see if other joint state staff have things they'd like to add.
Commissioner Woolley has his hand up, and then I have a question as well. Commissioner Woolley.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. So again, on the good news celebration, you know, with the slide, the Columbia River snake, the wild Chinook runs, it's, you know, it's great to see. You mentioned that those are managed by tribes and federal agencies. And I'm just wondering if there is anything that they're doing in the management realm that may be different in terms of their management approach. You know, is that a factor, or is it just simply environmental factors, just, you know, the same as in every other case that we're looking at?
Yeah, so the stocks are managed collectively by multiple co-managers in the basin, there is a Snake River Fall Chinook Hatchery program, a supplementation program that has existed for a number of years now to supplement that population. It's also because of changes in the hydro system management that have maybe increased juvenile survival has allowed for that stock to make a comeback. Specifically.
Chris Kern, you have your hand up.
Thanks. Yeah, I just, Charlene did a good job of talking about the in-river recovery aspects. I guess one I might add is also following the listing, there were additional reductions in harvest as well that contribute at least to some degree to this, and those follow out to Oh, Bill or somebody can tell me if I'm wrong, but the ocean impacts in PFMC area fisheries were reduced by at least 25 or 30%, maybe more. And then we've got much reduced rates in the river. So some fishery actions as well. I think the bigger part of that pie is probably related to those on the ground recovery aspects up in the area. And then just more generally, I think another factor that, you know, reflecting on the upriver bright graph earlier that is a little harder probably to quantify today, but does play some role, is when the Pacific Salmon Treaty was signed in 1985, there was an expectation that escapements to the Columbia would go up for certain stocks. And I recall, I think that was one of them. So some contribution over time in terms of changing of management of some of those ocean fisheries as well, plays some role in some of these stocks. Again, hard to tease those out from other things, but it should be in there as another factor. So anyway, thanks.
Charlene, I went through my 150 pounds of Columbia River files that I've had for some years now. And the question I have has to do with primarily wild stocks of summer Chinook. And they're red flagged that we have some concerns. I'd like to know how we're doing on meeting those objectives and escapements on systems on the Washington side, like the Wenatchee, Entiat, Chelan, Methow, Okanagan issues. I mean, how are we doing on those systems in the upper reaches that people from the east have very significant concerns about? And if you don't have that data in front of you, we can do it later, but I wanted to flag it for you.
Yeah, Thanks, Chair Carpenter. I don't have that data in front of me. What I do know is that we are meeting our USV Oregon summer Chinook escapement goals. In terms of the particular tributary numbers, I don't have that data, and there may be others on the call that have that in front of them or able to answer that better than I could. But certainly we can follow up as well.
Thank you so much.
And this is Bill Twight, just following up briefly on Charlene's. I think it's best just to pull together a supplemental briefing on that. The general picture is that we've done fairly well consistently in some of the tributaries and a couple of the other tributaries, achieving both the level of desired natural spawners and the desired PHAS remains sort of challenging. We're not sure how much of that is harvest and how much of that may just be the that we've aren't seeing the productivity out of those that we would expect.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that, Bill. I'll just look forward to a supplemental briefing on that when it's available. Thank you. Chair Wall.
The only thing I was going to say, Chair Carpenter, is that just in terms of time, we probably should move on and come back to this. We will need, of course, next time to look at the wild stocks separated out, and especially if we're going to be talking in terms of climate change and impacts in terms of more frequent temperature variations and that sort of thing. So I appreciate this that we had as an overview and getting the quick combined view, but I would like to see that separated out when we come back to it. And I think we should probably move on.
Fine with me. Okay. What do we have next, Don?
Next would be the economic business. And so I guess I'd go back to Charlene, who might be asking Nikki to pull up a couple of slides on that agenda item. And again, by way of introduction of this, this is a summary of some of the economic modeling information that was done in advance of the Washington Commission considering changes in the policy. And it had a significant effect on whether or not policy changes should be entertained or not. And so this is a matter of just, again, it's a background level thing. It's an understanding thing. And we didn't get to this kind of detail in any of the other meetings. This should only be a 30-minute matter or less, but it was an important factor for the Washington Commission to look at. And my understanding, they've just got a couple of slides here, and it should be of interest to us.
Yeah, thanks, Nikki. If you could bring up that presentation, it'd be helpful. And actually, John North with ODFW is going to start kick this off for us, and then I'll follow up on a last couple of slides. So I think we have about 6 content slides total. Shouldn't take us too long to get through this, but I'll hand it off to John.
Actually, yeah, Charlene, this is Tucker. If I could just start out real quick. I just wanted to give our commissioners just a brief heads up. John's going to walk through some of the basics of how this economic modeling was done. Sort of the foundation behind it, and I think Charlene's going to show some of the results at the end. But I did want to give you a heads up that this is, you know, fairly complicated stuff, and so it would be my expectation that you might have some questions when it's all over with, and you know, we're going to be happy to follow up with you later. But you know, I wouldn't expect to be able to fully digest everything you're going to get, and understanding that it's at 100,000 foot level, but just, I did want to give you the heads up on that. So, with that, John, who's, like I said, our fisheries manager, Columbia River Fisheries manager, and has been deeply involved in this and has a tremendous amount of knowledge, is going to sort of walk you through just really some of the basics. So, sorry about that. Didn't mean to jump in front of you, John, but did want to lay that groundwork.
No, that's fine. Thanks, Tucker. Good morning, commissioners, directors, and others. As mentioned, this part of the presentation is just a very brief review of the economic modeling process that's been associated with harvest reform, and just quickly walk through basic approach and assumptions, and then provide context for the Washington policy revisions, which Charlene will go over at the end. So Next slide. So economic value of our Columbia River fisheries has been a topic of much debate in recent years associated with the changes in the harvest reform policies. And so due to this, the I believe previous and current versions of the Oregon and Washington harvest reform policies have included guiding principles related to economics. Two of the simplest and most primary metrics that we've reviewed over time are recreational angler trips and commercial X vessel value, although we have also looked at regional income impacts and won't touch on that today. It's a little more complicated, but the modeling that staff has done has focused on trying to determine the effects of the changes in the ESA impact allocations among the fisheries and implementation of new commercial gears and what effects those have on economics and changes in smolt releases or production levels in the select area fisheries, which was it's really a kind of a key part, especially on the Oregon side, where you're trying to offset commercial reductions in the main stem with increased select area releases in those off-channel sites. Overall, one of the main goals of the modeling, it really has been to try and provide a way to evaluate the effects of the different policy options for comparison to alternatives and to what the outcome would have been if no policy changes had occurred, which we sometimes refer to the pre-policy baseline. Next slide. So as we started to develop this modeling approach, it quickly became apparent that factors other than those related to the policy decisions greatly affect the primary metrics of X vessel value and angler trips. For instance, you know, the overall salmonid return in a given year can vary greatly, and that affects the results of any given policy option. It's very powerful. So in this graph, just as an example, you can kind of see a general pattern of increased X vessel value in non-treaty commercial fisheries, which is the bars. They're color-coded, itemized by individual fishery. But if you just look at the overall total represented by the bars, you'll see that it's generally larger with larger runs, which is represented by the line, and decreases with lower runs. So even though there has been changes in allocations and other issues factors over time, this is a powerful driver. Next slide. And although it isn't quite as clean, we did see a similar pattern with angler trips and the annual salmonid returns. And I think some of the noise here is spring versus fall, how much of that's contributing to the overall return. But in general, saw this similar pattern where generally get lower effort on low returns and higher effort on high returns. So moving to the next slide, because of this powerful effect of these non-policy related variables, such as run size, smolt survival in select areas, recreational catch rates, we needed to come up with a way to isolate for just the effects of any given policy and its associated suite of ESA, you know, allocations and safe production and gear types. So what we came up with was an approach that compares what actually happened in any given fishery, whether it was sport or commercial, with what would likely have happened in the absence of any policy change. And the nice thing about this approach is it kind of standardizes for the annual variables that I've mentioned, and it provides better clarity regarding the effects of just the policy actions themselves. So for each year and each season and each fishery, both sport and commercial, we compared what actually the actual results of the fishery, whether it was trips or X vessel value, and those results were affected by the policy at the time, with what the expected results would have been had no policy been in place. And we used what we call a what is known when approach, and we stepped back through each fishery and each decision point within the season and determined how it would have performed with different allocations, or in the case of select area fisheries, different smolt releases. Obviously, it's a very time-consuming exercise, but we think it's the best and most accurate approach. Just for background, we chose the 2010 through 12 timeframe for establishing the base ESA allocations and safe releases for comparison with new policies, since that time period kind of predated the main harvest reform changes, and it was a fairly stable period for ESA allocations and safe production. And I wanted to mention that although the model was initially served to evaluate the policy effects of those changes on the recreational and commercial fisheries for a specific year after that year was already completed, the modeling also serves as a way to project the relative effects on future angling trips and commercial value for different policy options if we assume that the out-year conditions will average what occurred for fisheries since 2013. So in that sense, it's a little hard to comprehend, but if you just assume that the conditions that we experienced are fed into the model and those conditions will repeat themselves, then it allows you to produce a relative output for comparing different policies. So with each passing year, additional results are added to that model, making it more robust, but it's still not meant to be predictive. It's a relative tool. So I think with that, we could go to the next slide, and that's where Charlene will pick up.
Thanks, John. And I think for these next two tables, we have three different policy options being compared. So the one at the bottom here is the pre-policy that John was referring to, the 2010 to 2012 baseline. And then we have the current Oregon policy and the original Washington policy prior to the 2020 revisions. And so this just kind of shows you what went into these modeling scenarios, which assumptions. So the allocations for spring, summer, and fall, whether there were, pre-update tangle net fisheries, post-update tangle net fisheries in the spring, and then we have certain situations in the summer. And the original Washington policy and the current Oregon policy were pretty much identical, except for this post-update tangle net gill net spring fishery. And then, of course, the pre-policy had fisheries for most of these areas and years. So next slide, please, Nikki. So really, the sort of the main focus for this was to speak to the differences at a high level between sport angler trips and commercial ex vessel value across the three policies that we have here. So we have our pre-policy base case, our 2018 Washington policy, and the current Oregon policy. And really the main difference between these is that there was an increase in angler trips with the current Oregon and original Washington policies compared to the base case. And that was approximately about 15,000 angler trips added. But there was a decrease in commercial ex vessel value of, depending on which policy you're looking at, 1.2 to 1.6 million compared to the pre-policy base case. And we just broke out the commercial ex vessel value here for sort of total, and then also into the main stem and safe subcategories. And the actual report on this has a lot more detail for the various fisheries within each of these areas. But for sort of this discussion, we thought sort of keeping it simpler was better. So. I think there's one more slide, but it's just a questions slide. And so that's where I'll leave it here.
Any questions for Charlene or John? Okay, thank you. Next, please.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Commissioner McIsaac.
just a point here. So in terms of if you were going to go to the next agenda item on this one here on the economics, in terms of commissioner to commission, commissioner discussion, let me say that I think the staff did a very nice job in this economic modeling exercise, which is a very complicated matter, as John North said. But if you can normalize the effective run sizes so that if the economics go up because there's a big run coming back from the ocean due to bonanza conditions out there, or if the economics go down terribly because there was a blob or an El Nino out there, you need to normalize the run sizes to get to an idea of whether the policy caused or gets any credit for that. And similarly, on, for example, price per pound in the commercial fishery. If there's a big price for salmon internationally or the bottom falls out in the market, then that's going to make a big change in the economics. And the modeling normalizes for all of that. So again, just to serve a purpose of what was meaningful to the Washington Commission in passing new policies. Maybe if we could go back to that slide, that last slide that Charlene had on there, or Nikki, I guess you'd be the one to put up the last slide of a comparison. What we were looking at in terms of asking ourselves the question of should we look into making some changes here. We looked back to the original purpose of the policy reform business back in 2013, and it was to do a whole variety of things and in the end have it be better for the commercial fishery and better for the sport fishery, and in particular better for the sport fishery, which was going to get higher allocations. And the commercial fishery was going to be made up for reductions in terms of better things in terminal area fisheries, including trying to find a Young's Bay in Washington and implementing alternative gear very quickly by 2016. And when we looked at this and we looked at the sport angler trips, we didn't see the kind of boost we'd hoped for. We looked at the commercial value as a total, and we're looking at not getting anywhere near about $5 million in X vessel value after you've normalized for run size and price per pound and all the rest. And in particular, in the main stem areas, a drop of, over 50%. And so the safe areas did increase. Young's Bay has been a success story in many regards, but on the Washington side, there was not a safe area situation that made up for it. So it was compelling to take a look at the economics here and say, well, maybe we ought to really try to do something different, because if we continue along these lines, it's not going to work out as originally intended on an economic basis. So that was kind of our takeaway as we went into September of 2021. If there's some commissioner to commissioner discussion about this, this might fall into the same category as a big overview. Can we follow up later? Because the economic stuff does get so complicated. But before going on to the next one, if there's any particular questions that the Oregon commissioners would like to see further investigated or any of that, this is just, again, a high level, as Tucker Jones said, a high level shot of overview, and more to come later if commissioners want to see it.
If I may, Don, Chair Wall has her hand up, and then I have a question as well.
Thank you to both of you and for the slideshow and explanations. It's very useful to get this stuff. The way I'm looking at this is a discussion about the economics of how we spend the resource. And that's critical. It's critical to know the industrial outcomes, the industry component to industry component outcomes as these different policies occur. What's missing for me, and we can't get into it today at all, of course, is that there are natural resource values of the resource itself as it increases or decreases. And there would, for instance, be what happens in the region with wild stock being listed or extirpated or in decline, what happens to our economy and to especially to our resource? So I think those broader questions, you know, we can divide this world into the economics of the what happens with our various allocation and gear type decisions, and those are critical. We also, because we have to be looking at the resource itself, need to look at the economics of what happens to the region if we have these stocks in increase or in decline. So that's a discussion for later. We sure don't need to get into it now, but I think we need both sides of that economic world when we get into it.
Okay, I'm going to hold my question to later, perhaps under a meeting wrap-up. So we'll move down to the next agenda item now, the new Washington policy provision overview.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to take the lead on this. And again, it's just an introductory matter to maybe take a little baby step towards the idea of somewhere down the road having a joint concurrency on policy and regulatory matters. We left the meeting last time thinking, well, we've got quite a bit in common here on our conservation concerns. A lot of that is in the Washington policy. And so maybe it'd be good to note that. And so I'm going to, in a moment, run through our Washington policy document and show, I don't know, half a dozen or so spots where it struck me that we have some policy concurrency on conservation business already. And there's probably more, but anyway, just to say a few and offer the opportunity for some commissioner to commissioner discussion about those ideas, adding more to those, how to move on. I'm going to stay completely and totally away from any fishery allocation business. This is just a little inching toward a discussion of where we have things in common. I think Jim Anderson spoke to that earlier. So let me see if I can do this. And if it turns out that my I guess I would ask Jim Anderson if he could, and there it is right there. Your internet connection is unstable, just right on. Right on cue. So here's our new policy, and it starts with a purpose that I think is something we have in common.
Hey, Don, just try turning off your camera, maybe.
I think he's gone.
Let's see. I'm going to have to. The only way I know how to do that is to do this. So let's try and see. Let's see if we can do this here. There. Can you see that and can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Again, apologize for the internet connection up here on the top of Ice Mountain. It gets rough. Maybe a half a dozen spots where I think we have things in common. Our purpose statement about conservation that I just read, number two, does not impair the resource and maintains economics of sustainable fisheries in the waters of which the states of Oregon and Washington have concurrent jurisdiction. So I think that's a matter of common intent. We have a section of authority and a definition and intent that I'll skip over. As a general policy statement, I've highlighted this section about fishery and hatchery management measures implemented as part of an all-age strategy that integrates hatchery, harvest, hydro system, and habitat actions designed to increase the abundance. And that was spoken to earlier. Last meeting, we talked about SAR, smolt to adult survival rates in the hydro system. And that was a lot of our discussion on the Washington side as well. And so that struck me as something that I think we probably have in common. I'll scroll down to the guiding principles. we're in our document, we've got a section on conservation, protection, and recovery. Number three is advocate for increased downstream and upstream survival of salmon and steelhead through the Columbia River hydropower system. At our last meeting, we again had a presentation on hydro system impacts and a governor's agreement to move down the road on that. So we're together on that, I think. Orderly and concurrent regulated fisheries. I highlighted here number four, integrate the use of new alternative commercial gear in the main stem Columbia River in a manner that maintains orderly commercial and recreational fisheries in the Columbia River and its tributaries. I think that's something we have in common. I'll scroll down to general provisions, again, development of and implementation of alternative commercial fishing gear. Hatchery and natural production goals. And I think Chair Wall, that would be good. In establishing hatchery and natural production goals, the department shall consider the policy guidance described above, goals described in the National Fisheries Service sponsored Columbia Basin Partner Task Force report. So we had a big presentation on that last time, and it had a lot of good stuff in it. Well, scientific monitoring. This came up in our first meeting where we're calling for better science wherever we can get it. And I've highlighted the part about emphasizing scientific studies for T exists. I think that's something we've spoken of jointly before. Thermal angling sanctuaries is another area I think we have of common ground in our policy. If you can hear it through all the noise in the background, was to sit. I'm going to scroll through the last one. I'm going to scroll past all of the allocation business to the end. The adaptive management business, we were calling for recognizing that in addition to management performance uncertainty, there are many unpredictable events, including climate change, changes in long-term environmental patterns. So we're going to go. And that's it. So out in common so far, and we're hoping.
Did we lose you, Don?
Testing 1, 2, 3.
Well, you're back. You're back. Now, that was hard to get through. You got it across well, but you were breaking up pretty significantly.
I'm.
Well, I would ask if there are any questions from anyone, but I don't know that we could probably put them on the table right now. Can everybody hear me? Jim, do you want to go ahead and say something?
Well, my guess is Don will be back on shortly, but no one was praying more than I was that he would get through his presentation. So, but I do think that, that one of the things on the just the conservation with regard to the principles, the policy that we've adopted includes not only ESA, promoting a recovery of ESA populations of salmon and steelhead, but also the conservation of non-ESA listed wild stocks to achieve conservation goals. So I think that's something that was in addition to what we had in the earlier document. So
okay, feedback, Don. Thank you, Jim. Don, is that a wrap for you on this item?
Yeah, I might just ask one question about the alternative gear emphasis in terms of that being something in common of an interest to us. So we've had that in our new Washington policy. I guess I'd ask for some Oregon commissioner level input on whether that's something that we should log into a common a thing that we have in common as we look down the road to the future of policy business. You may not have heard me mention that there appears to be a new pound net, a permanent pound net under construction in the Oregon waters and Clifton Channel, which signals to us that maybe you are. But I wondered if you could speak to any of that in terms of commonality of approach.
Chair Rawl, is that a question you want to take or defer to someone else?
Well, I will say a couple things, but I think we really should defer it perhaps to either of the other commissioners if they want to say anything, or to the director if he'd like to add anything. And I think that in the most general terms, we have not had the presentations on pound nets and their effectiveness that you folks have had. Several people on the Oregon side, I think, are following those, including the one that's now on the Oregon side. Our department, as I understand it, is not involved in that effort and study. And certainly the idea of having alternative gear that works for people and that is more selective would be a good thing. That said, I think that, like all of the other pieces, fit into the category of what we heard from the Columbia River Basin report, which is there are the goals. I think that we aren't so different perhaps on our goals. And then we are going to get into, as Commissioner Woolley and then Commissioner Baker said last time, it's important to translate those to what those actions might look like and what of those actions might be in our wheelhouse and have some effect on, for instance, the SARs and increasing above the 2 and 4 and getting maybe to the 4%. So I think that the short version is, yes, we have a lot in common on our goals. And I think it's great that we're having this conversation and look forward to getting into how those translate into moving forward to conserve the runs and increase the runs and get into what actions might be appropriate. So I would look to the other commissioners or to the director who may have some great things on this one as well.
Let me just say that I agree. I think that we're quite concurrent on these general policy goals. The purpose statement, the advocacy for downstream survival of salmon, hatchery and natural production goals. You know, especially the scientific monitoring and leaning on the best science available. I think we're a little bit ahead on the thermal sanctuaries, but it's good that you at least have the policy statements in place and are working toward that. And of course, addressing climate change. So I think, in these general areas, I feel that we are quite concurrent. And I think it's always good to start a discussion with commonality before talking about differences. So I appreciate that. Commissioner McIsaac for laying that out. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd say that was, although it was difficult to get through, I put it up on my screen so I could follow along because your screen wasn't following along with what you're talking about. Those are all things that we've talked about that we would like to see as conservation issues in the Columbia River. But I would like to hear from Director Melcher on the pound net that's on the Oregon side, or whatever type of net it is.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I think, you know, as a general, and the commission has been pretty clear on this in the past, that as, you know, as a general rule, we're not opposed to continued or additional alternative gear research, but it's not been the highest priority of activities that we're funding now in Oregon. So, and we are aware of the pound net that's going in on the Oregon side of the river, and we look forward to seeing the results from that site. I will say, just on a, you know, on a side editorial note, it gives us pause anytime you have to drive, you know, 75 or 100 pilings in the estuary and all the things that come along with that. We've been working so hard over the years to try and, you know, to try and remove pilings. And so that does give us pause, but I don't think it's, obviously it's not something that that folks haven't been able to work through. That's all I would say at this point.
Okay, real quickly, we got to move on, but I think this is an issue we need to put on our agenda for future meetings. I think it is something that's moving forward, and I think we need to learn more about it. So, Commissioner McIsaac, you have the last comment on this item.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think this will give you your time savings year after. You said my biggest point there is that it sounds like that on the matter of alternative gear, that we're in some initial steps of discussion here. We'd like to talk more about it in a careful manner. We had also expressed some concern about permanent piling driving in the lower Columbia River, as opposed to maybe some floating pound nets or some other approach. But to the extent that you are looking somewhere down the road, entertain the possibility of alternative gear when it can outperform the current fishery in terms of Chinook per steelhead, for example, that if those discussions can be moved forward sometime down the road as we continue these discussions, if it's on the screen, that's a good thing.
Okay. Chair Wall, are you in agreement with putting that on an agenda for our future meetings?
That works fine for me.
Thank you. Thank you, Don, for a good presentation. Yeah. We are now down to number three, climate change presentation. So far, I think we're on schedule. Before we go to that, Commissioner Woolley has his hand raised.
Oh, yeah, just right quick. I just wanted to say that we're not ignoring that fact that you brought up, that the commercials didn't get a boost in the plan, you know, in our Governor Kitzhaber's plan, and that everything that we had aspired to didn't materialize. You know, the safe areas weren't as productive. You know, Young's Bay did pretty well, but you know, we would also hear that there really wasn't enough room for them to maneuver, or that, you know, the main stem is really where the money fish are, you know, and that sort of thing. So I just wanted to say, I mean, we're not ignoring that point that you made as you were leading into the policy concurrency discussion. We're aware of those shortcomings.
Thank you, Commissioner Woolley. Okay, joint staff on climate change presentation.
Yeah, Commissioner Carpenter, I am trying to get my video going here. This is Chris Kern. I had a little bit of issue with it, but let me see how about that? You got me now?
Perfect.
Okay, now let's see if I can get step two to work, which is to share my screen. All right, hopefully
looks
you can
good.
See a yeah. slideshow. Okay. Hang on just a second. I want to make sure I'm back at the top. Apologize for the dinging noise. My computer's making noises. So, Chris Kern from ODFW. I will say I coordinated with Washington folks on this. In particular, Dr. Marissa Litz was really helpful in trying to add some material from the Washington perspective, as well as just her frankly great expertise on climate notion issues. Sorry she couldn't join us today, but my understanding is she was otherwise occupied. So I'm going to do this solo, but wanted to let you know that we did engage on this together. So again, I won't read through all of this, but we were asked to talk about climate change and the effect of climate change on fish and fisheries at the last meeting. Didn't quite get time to go into it, which frankly was fortunate. Gave me some time to put a little more effort into it as well. Generally speaking, and I think both commissions are relatively pretty aware of all these issues. We've been very active at the Oregon Commission and agency in discussing climate change. Had a workshop just last summer in which we reviewed a number of things that are probably going to be similar to what we touch on today. So can't go to super great depth, also in the interest of time, but I want to hit a few things here. Number one being that our biggest expectation relative to climate change, in particular for salmon, but also other species, is that the nexus for that's largely going to be a lot of habitat-driven effects. But also that we know those impacts, we don't expect them to be uniform across the landscape or across the oceanscape, as it were. A number of factors listed here that we think, among others, certainly not exhaustive, that bear on fish and fish species in particular. And so, you know, I I'm not going to plan on reading through the list. I'm sure you've all seen versions of these before, but, you know, river flows, temperatures, ocean conditions is a big one we've talked about a lot. Also, other species coming in and changes to the native species we're talking about as well. So one of the fundamental ones, though, that we expect in particular to salmonids relative to fishery management is changes to abundance and productivity from a result of these things. And so just a little bit about how we may incorporate these kinds of considerations into our management processes. And I'm going to try and hit just a few examples. Again, we don't have time to get exhaustive, and I think both commissions are working towards more detailed assessments of these things already. So again, just hit a few. We've got forecasting and stock assessment processes. We've talked a fair bit about those. The reaction of our fishery management, or what I call harvest control rules, to some of those situations. Other protective measures, we talked about very briefly thermal sanctuaries already. Can we identify early warning and climate indicators and then also coordinate that information? I'll mention that coordination is recognized pretty clearly in one of our guiding principles for Oregon's new climate policy the commission adopted last year as another key example for things we need to be doing. So that's coordination with other entities who have a lot of expertise. We actually spent a fair bit talking about some of that at our last commission meeting as well. And finally, relative to some of the conversations that was going on earlier is the recognition that we're talking about fisheries management in this slideshow, but that's one aspect of this process, and other actions are important to improve the status of our fish stocks. So, you know, we talked, there was some discussion earlier about smolt to adult rates and the effects of hydro system and other things that we talked about at the last joint meeting. Very important things. Again, the all H approach is a good one to think about here. We've got some real challenges that are not necessarily fisheries management related. I think you're all aware of those. So I'm just going to break these down kind of by pieces. And so the first one I have is forecasting and stock assessment. And again, trying to avoid reading the slides. Really, it's can we add utility to our processes that help us in our management by including environmental variables or something similar? And so I've got a couple of examples of those. I want to point out, though, that the simple exercise of including the variable, and this is probably obvious to folks, but the simple exercise of including some environmental variable isn't in itself a panacea. It has to be a useful environmental variable. In other words, it has to provide utility to that process. And that requires a pretty careful evaluation and also understanding the relationships and mechanisms that are in play in driving whatever you're trying to describe. So that's where a lot of the research and effort is directed today, is trying to identify those kinds of things. Can't talk about climate change and ocean conditions without having our stoplight chart from our friends at NOAA. Just really wanted this here to remind me to speak to the fact that there is a lot of new information becoming available over time that we think can be informative to fisheries management and salmon management in particular. And it is starting to make its way into our processes as that understanding gets better. So one example I've used before in our discussions at Oregon, on the Oregon shore, is incorporation of environmental variables into the Oregon Coast Natural Coho forecast. And real quick, I'll just orient you to this slide. We had a methodology for forecasting that stock, and then it was updated in about 2011 to incorporate some more ocean-centric environmental variables. I say more because the old version actually had some environmental variables in it too, but I think they were largely freshwater focused. On the left of this is only one of these environmental variables, and you really don't need to pay attention too much to what it is. It happens to be the Pacific Decadal S Oscillation Index, which is just one of many measures you can look at. And if you just notice, the point of the graph is just to show the pattern of recruits, which is the offspring produced, and the pattern of that PDO over that time series line up pretty well, which is a reasonable indication that there's some correlation there and that there's some relationship, even if you may not be able to tease out exactly what it is. The right-hand side is the sort of effect of including a suite of environmental variables, including that one on the left, but not just that, on the forecast accuracy for that stock over the time period that this report came out, which again was pre-2011. So this does not incorporate recent data. But if you'll see, the old forecast model is the one in red. And then the actual is the black line. And you can see that those deviated pretty poorly. You'll see they were okay early on, and then they deviated. And that deviation is really what prompted the review. And the new model is also not perfect, but does fit much better with the pattern. So this is an example where inclusion of that kind of variable was absolutely useful and is still in use as a result. And this is one I can't speak to with a lot of expertise, because this is one of the things that Dr. Litz provided, but Washington's Lower Columbia Natural Coho forecast had been done using sibling regressions with jack returns. And as with the prior graph, they sort of started to deviate from the observed, becoming uncoupled with the actual observations. And so a new approach was derived, essentially using, environmental indicators to predict the marine survival, and then using that in the total estimate about migrating smolts. They're using a model evaluation procedure to select the best fitting model that I probably won't go into. But again, you see the observed values in for marine survival in the black and the predicted survival in blue. So they do track fairly well. Okay, another one that we have not talked about in the Oregon side, Oregon discussions, we've talked about forecasts a fair bit, but another place that we can consider this environmental sort of approach is in our more basic stock assessment or population dynamics model. And this is a figure coming from some work I did several years ago. And I'm not going to try and dig into the depth of what this is describing too much, but this is really a fairly standard figure, what we would call the stock recruitment function. So it's simply put, if you see the number of spawners in a given year, can you predict how many offspring or recruits those fish will produce? And so this is a very standard model approach, often used to describe the dynamics of the population. It can be used for any number of things like population viability assessment, fishing evaluations, whole host of things that aren't really important here. But what I wanted to demonstrate here is that this is essentially a model, and it is trying to predict the abundance of offspring solely looking at the abundance of the spawners. And the best fit line for that relationship is shown here. And I will see if I can use my mouse. So that is the fitted line, least squares regression sort of approach through the observed data points, which are the blue. And you can see that while the trend and direction sort of track each other, there's quite a bit of variance from the predicted to the actual observations. And I've circled one large one. So essentially that gray dot at the top of it, the inside of that red circle, is what this model would predict should happen in that year. but that blue circle is what actually was observed. So you can see that it didn't describe it very well for that data point. And now I'll show you something else that's a little different. Excuse me, back to the other screen. I've dropped that fitted line because this model now includes a covariate, we call it, which in this case is actually marine survival. So kind of similar to what the Washington forecast graph was using, but a little different. The details of it don't really matter in this case. But what does matter is now we have two variables that are predicting recruits, spawners and this survival variable. That survival variable could easily be replaced with some kind of environmental variable if it was found useful. I could argue that the survival index itself is reflective of environmental conditions and therefore is kind of doing the same thing. The take home is, if you look at the red circle again, that is exactly the same data point from the prior figure. And you will note that the predicted value in black is far closer to that circle than it was on the prior page. So this is simply just another way we can incorporate things like environmental variables in some of our basic fishery work. So moving to the next section, harvest control rules sort of discussion. So our fishery management approaches. And we know that climate change, we're expecting to affect some onage in a lot of ways, but many of those will be manifested as responses in abundance and productivity. And so what drives that is variable, but from a management standpoint, one of our main goals is going to be able to react to reduced abundances in our fisheries management. And we have several examples of how we currently do that that we can use as examples. And I've got a couple pulled from our processes for the Columbia under the USV Oregon agreement. So I'll give you some examples. I'll note that these approaches are responsive to the observations. And so if we consider the responses of the population to climate change or really any other factor as the output or outcome of a set of scenarios, we're looking for harvest control rules that can react to that. And then I'll follow up with an example that these don't have to be and aren't generally fully static over time. They can be adapted as conditions change. So I'll go through those a bit. This is one of the examples from the Columbia. It's Upper River Spring Chinook harvest rate allowances for ESA impacts on the non-tribal fisheries. For orientation purposes, I have reversed this figure. So the left side of the x-axis is the large abundance end, the high abundance end of the scale. The right is below it. And I did that so that we could just kind of read left to right. And then you'll see the harvest rate is on the y-axis. So the point of this is, that you note that as the abundance declines, that harvest rate drops. And as it declines at the very low end, it drops quite a bit. Another way to think of this is that as that abundance declines, we are managing to ensure that an increasing proportion of what does come back is passed through the fisheries. So you'll note the highest allowable rate on this figure, if you look at the scale, is happens to be 2.7%. And the lowest is between 0 and 1.5%. The zero is relevant because at those really low numbers, we seek to minimize all impacts and could be down to zero. So essentially, under a scenario where reduced abundance becomes more common, whether it's from climate change or some other factor, we anticipate spending more time down at this lower end than we might currently spend in the middle or the upper end. So less frequency at the high end, potentially, probably, and more frequency at the low end relative to the harvest rate. Similar example, again, I don't have to go into too much detail on this one. It's set up the same way, and this is for Snake River Wildfall Chinook. So this was a stock that was up in the earlier presentation. It's one of the ESA-listed stocks that drives much of the management in the fall season in particular, but the same basic pattern. Again, you'd see under reduced abundance, much more time spent down in this lower end of the scale as opposed to the higher end and more frequently. Another point that I think we, Charlene pointed out earlier in a manner is sort of the weak stock approach. I think she touched on that some. Most of the fisheries in our region, PFMC and Columbia River in particular, we're talking about fisheries where there could be mixed stocks, and where those occur, you are constraining all the fisheries in order to protect those weak stocks within it. And so you harvest of some of the healthier stocks can be foregone or controlled by the requirements for protecting the weaker portions within. Another thing that's really important for our management, which isn't necessarily directly weak stock, but it does bear on it, is, you know, the PFMC, as well as our own processes, are all annual to reevaluate the fisheries based on what's going on currently. They don't stay the same from year to year. And in fact, year to year differences can be substantial. And those are almost always in reaction to changes in which stocks are driving or weakest within those aggregates and the need to protect those. And so this is the part that Charlene touched on earlier as well, is within the Columbia, we do that at an even finer scale. So we do the annual updates with forecasts and everything else. But where we've got dam count data and other information to update real time, what the abundances are, what the stock composition is, any differences in run timing, we're taking those kinds of things into account as well. Okay, so control rules don't have to be static. We can and have changed harvest control rules over time to adapt to either new information or changing conditions or any number of things. Just a few examples here listed from just the PFMC realm alone, and not going into even the state management side where we're doing similar things in various places. So a few examples over the last few years where the council has reevaluated the process for managing those fisheries, and an example of the Southern Oregon, Northern California Coho Working Group, which is actually kind of looking at this right now, just had a meeting last week. So the only point is these things can and do change. Okay, so a few other management responses that are kind of a little different from control rules and those kinds of things. A couple examples I'll use, and one was touched on already, is thermal sanctuaries. And the other one, unfortunately, I've just called other actions, but I'll tell you what's contained in that in a bit. It's a suite of things. But we've got some examples. So we've got thermal sanctuaries. Some of these other examples are things like manager efforts to provide additional space or room between the harvest rate experienced by the stock and the rates they're allowed. In other words, some buffer to stay below the limits. We've had some recent examples of those with summer steelhead, with 2020 spring Chinook return, 2020 fall Chinook planting. All of those are examples where the managers established or implemented a approach that was below the ceilings on purpose and to be conservative. So thermal angling sanctuary, I'm only showing one. I think folks are aware Oregon adopted three of these last year. This one's the Deschutes. We also have rules in place for Hermit Creek and Eagle Creek. And these are known areas where the inflows during the peak temperature period for the Columbia from these tributaries are colder, and we expect and have observed that in particular, summer steelhead will pull into those areas as sanctuaries or as refuge from the temperature. And so we now have angling regulations to provide additional protections to them while they're in those areas. These are important because as you know, cold water is going to become even more important under the climate change future that we are heading towards. So just another example. Here's the other sort of category I just wanted to point out that was a pretty immediate one that came to mind for me was in 2015 when we experienced the extreme drought. I managed to go back and find some of the categories that ODFW kind of looked at in our action responses. And I don't know if Washington has a similar set. I know we were all experienced extreme drought that year. And I know we took some joint actions on the Columbia as well. But sort of categories, we had closures targeted protecting native fish species. So some of those were full area closures. Some of them were what we call the hoot owl restriction, which is the afternoon closure when temperatures peak. A lot of voluntary advisories encouraging people to fish when it was cooler. We also liberalized opportunities where we had non-natives and game fish where we expected a lot of increased mortality, like pond fisheries, for example, adjustments to some of our operations. And then one that kind of maybe doesn't jump right to the front, but actually is really important as we think about things like climate change, where we have drought that's drawn down a water level and we have a problem with some kind of a non-native or invasive that we want to try and do some eradication work on. That provides a really good opportunity, and we took advantage of some of those as well. Okay, we are nearing the end here. I'm trying to move along. I wanted to not have this one say other as well, so I've kind of titled this as broader conversations, and these are really kind of some of the higher level policy, regional actions, and local actions that are kind of relevant here or highly relevant here. For Oregon, Commission adopted our forage fish management plan in 2016, which is definitely important relative to climate change and maintaining forage fish in our local area, in our ocean ecosystem. As I mentioned earlier, the commission adopted the climate and ocean policy in 2020. Key principles within that policy that I think I mentioned earlier, we've got coordination, key principle, working with other folks, science, where we are shifting some of the science to places where we think we can best utilize it in preparation and mitigation and adaptation to climate change. Species and habitat management, which bears a lot on what we're talking about in this slideshow. And then also the agency's own footprint relative to carbon and climate change adaptation and communicating what we're doing. Marissa provided me some information on Washington as well relative to the agency's efforts to manage its own operations and assets relative to climate change. So it sounds very similar to our footprint discussion in Oregon. And understand that the Washington Fish Program has a climate action team ongoing, working on what's needed to become to be dealing with climate change down the road. So I can't speak with any familiarity to it, but I appreciate getting that in there as well. Pacific Fishery Council, Dr. McIsaac probably remember many of these because I think a lot of them occurred under his tenure as the executive director of the council, but council prohibited harvest of krill in 2005, adopted a fishery ecosystem management, fishery management plan in 2013. And under that plan, they formed a new advisory subpanel, which is the ecosystem advisory subpanel, to provide input and advice to the council. They've also started some ecosystem initiatives, and a couple of the highlights for those, forage fish fishery management plan in 2016 that sought to ensure we don't have fisheries taking up on forage fish stocks that we don't know much about and are currently not managed or fished. So protecting that resource. Coordinated ecosystem indicator review in 2016, something I referenced in my last presentation to our commission, the annual California Current Ecosystem Report, which is a science update basically that the council gets every year now on what's going on in the California Current Ecosystem. And then very recently, a climate and communities initiative, which is I haven't been directly involved in, though some of our staff have. It's been a very broad reaching effort to bring folks from fishing communities and others together to talk about climate change and sort of envision what the future could look like under a couple of fairly broad scenarios and be working on trying to kind of flesh out what resiliency might look like under those kind of scenarios and start providing more information for planning purposes down the road. So that's been very active. Our marine program has been quite involved in that. And I'm probably near the very end. I think this is my last slide. Pacific Salmon Commission has done a few things as well. We did a full review of many of the Chinook forecasts in 2016 for the methodologies. Following the blob and some of the other climate extremes we saw several years ago, the commission funded a report to summarize what they call it now the Extrema Report. It essentially looked to kind of summarize some of the really outliers that were observed in that year, whether they be temperature, whether they be biological response of certain fish stocks. And then the upcoming here this year, there will be a workshop for fishery managers sponsored by the PSC Southern panel for the internal community for now of those folks that are engaged in that. That may broaden at some point later on, so I'll be participating in that. And then finally, a whole list of some other places where you've got folks involved. And I won't read too many of them, but I'll hit the top one that Magnus and Stevens Act reauthorization have been seeing quite a bit of news on pieces of that discussion that are working towards more inclusion of climate issues within that reauthorization. So we'll be keeping an eye on that as well. That's the end, and hopefully I didn't take too much more time than was hoped, but I'd be happy to take any questions.
Chris, I just would like to reach out and thank you for that. That was really well done. There's certainly more than I can absorb in the immediate future, but we'll be talking more. I've got three hands up. We'll start in this case with the lady, Vice Chair Baker.
Thank you. Chris, my question is just a real question. It's on your slides 10 and 11 when you were talking about the harvest control rules. One was related to reduced abundance and one was on a weak stock approach. And it shows you were talking about this as sort of a possibility. What I'm wondering is if PFMC does set these impact rates, and if so, do they happen prospectively before a season, or is there ever an adaptive management approach when the runs don't come in as expected, rather than just reducing harvest, maybe even the different agencies reduce the impact rates sort of midstream?
Yeah, Commissioner Baker, I moved the slide up that I think you may have been referring to. Did I get that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so this and the next one. Okay, and the next one, this one as well?
Yeah.
These two examples are strictly river management examples. And so these are specified under the U.S. versus Oregon Management Agreement, and the states of Oregon, Washington coordinate on managing fisheries for these two harvest rates. And we absolutely do kind of what I think you were describing, which is we start with a forecast for these stocks, but we update that forecast often more than once in a given week. I've seen it happen. And so you've got a couple things. If the run size comes down, you do automatically drop. Let me just use this example real quick here. Sorry. If you can see my mouse, and maybe I'll go back to this one. You see these steps. And so if you've got a forecast that you think you're going to be at this point right up here, but in-season information tells you you're down here, we absolutely make those changes in season and restrict fisheries and can do so very quickly and have. The other thing that I didn't put up here that is because it complicates the discussion quite a bit for a simple slide is for upriver spring Chinook, we're also using a 30% run size buffer. So any of these individual steps, let's say it's a 300,000 fish forecast, we will automatically take 30% off of that before we set any fisheries and just set that aside. And typically that will move us down to the next tier as well. So we're absolutely doing those things. I hope that answers your question.
And so thank you. That definitely clarifies. So then my follow-up question is, does that happen in the mainstream as well?
Yeah, Commissioner Baker, these are all main stem. Sorry, I should have probably led with that. These are all control rules relative to the main stem. The main stem Columbia fishery. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, next would be Vice Chair Woolley and then Commissioner Anderson. Commissioner Woolley.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Carpenter. So, Chris, could you just briefly, and I know we're trying to have enough time at the end, so you don't have to go into a lot of detail, talk more about the additional environmental indicators that were added in 2011. And I'm wondering, were they weighted in any way? And how do they affect the output, were they added in just kind of an equal measure?
Commissioner Will, you're talking about the Oregon Coast Coho forecast change, I think.
Yeah. Well, the page where in 2011, the model, you shifted the model. So,
Unfortunately,
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't really answer that question. I don't know the details of the model itself and how the structure, frankly, is a more complicated structure than I was used to dealing with, and I wasn't directly involved in it. I do not think they carry equal weight by any stretch, but I don't know the details. I do know they used what we would call some model selection criteria to pick out which of these. I think they looked at dozens of variables and they settled on the ones that seemed to be the most important. The mechanisms that they used to evaluate that, I don't know because I wasn't involved. And so there was a selection process of some kind to pick out the most important or the variables, as I would say it, the variables that explain the most variance. And then focus on those. And I would almost guarantee they don't carry equal weight within the model, but I couldn't give you much more than that.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Chris.
Okay. Sure. We have three hands up. We'll go to Commissioner Anderson first, Chair Wall second, and Commissioner Zarnowitz third, please. Mr. Anderson.
Okay. Interesting and good presentation. I'd be very interested in getting a copy of the presentation to look over, so that could be done or somebody could refer me to the right place. I would appreciate that. Sure. Obviously, it's complicated, but it strikes me that the broad framework discussion is absolutely critical and one that appears to be developing, and at the Pacific Salmon Treaty and Pacific Council and the like, because, you know, all these, everything is connected, as we know, and what goes on up there or in those processes really does affect the river. So, but also, as you point out, there's in-river or kind of local action. And so we've got both kind of this broad framework that really needs to be developed beyond what we can do as commissions. And then there's also the in-river things that the departments do that I think we're doing in many cases, but maybe need to do more or highlight those. And so it seems like we're talking, you know, maybe buffers to buffers to buffers, which gets, you know, gets complicated. But is there reluctance to get into this discussion at the broad levels, or is it a process delay kind of thing? It just takes a while to get it all teed up. And can we be expecting to see product that can be very helpful to us, or in what time frame?
Sure, Commissioner. Yeah, thanks for the question. I'm going to give you the response based on my own personal experience, recognizing I do work in a bunch of forums, but not all of them by any stretch. So if other folks like Bill Twight or somebody want to chime in, I'd certainly welcome that. My sense is these kinds of considerations, in particular, climate change as a topic of its own and trying to adapt and mitigate and build in resilience as its own end, but also within that incorporation of better and more well-understood environmental variables is absolutely where all the bodies I'm involved in are moving towards that. Now, are they doing it at different speeds and different ways? Sure, that's probably to be expected, but those bodies are specifically formed for the purposes of these kinds of coordinations. And they are moving towards that. I don't think there's reluctance to sort of go there. I don't think that's the word you use, but I don't think there's really reluctance. I do think it comes down to making sure you understand or being able to build things in as the understanding grows is probably the better way to say it for me. So I don't think there's reluctance. I think everybody is aware to at least some degree, some more than others, sure, that these kinds of factors are going to be a part of our future and need to be. But also there is just a lot of work and a lot of difficulty. And we're also, I think there's probably plenty of folks on this call that are aware that, you know, as we're trying to forecast things that we haven't seen before, that gets real difficult to do. We tend to be heavily reliant on things we've seen before and using that information to make interpolation or predictions of what might happen in the future. And as those background conditions start to change underneath us, that makes things a lot harder. And so that's a factor as well.
Thank you.
Chair Wall, please. And then Commissioner Zarnowitz and then Commissioner McIsaac. Chair Wall.
Thank you. Chris, I have two questions that are specific, and then I would like to go back to a more general one, following up, if you will, on Commissioner Anderson's point about this being a big picture question, and it should be, as he said. So my specifics are on, you said that the Magnuson-Stevenson Act requires more climate change risk be factored in. Could you say a little bit more about what that means and what it looks like to do that?
Sure, Chair Wall. If I said it that way, I said it improperly. What I was referring to is that the Magnuson Act has been for several years now in the process of being reauthorized and updated. And what I was referring to is simply that I have been seeing some things in the news about increased efforts to try to start incorporating more in there. That's not a done deal yet, but there are certainly people that are trying to, and I don't know the details of what aspects, I've only recently seen it, that they're trying to add, but just a note that there is a definite recognition that there could be some value in doing that.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. That helps. Sure. In terms of clarification, I thought it sounded like they were further on, but I misunderstood that one. In terms of the buffers that we have for various things, what I understood, I think, is that we had a buffer of, say, 30% on built into our forecast because the forecasts are tough to get accurate in advance. Do we have similar buffers built into these forecasts based on climate change? And I think the answer is probably yes. But if you could say a little bit more about what buffers we're building in because of the risk and uncertainty that comes with climate change.
Oh, Chair Wall, I'm not aware of, I need to think a little bit to see if I can think of any. I'm not aware of any that are explicitly for climate change purposes, but I think they are. So if I use the Spring Chinook buffer example, the purpose of that was, there's an extensive purpose to it relative to treaty, non-treaty sharing and making sure we're meeting the terms of the agreement relative to the tribal side and the non-tribal side that I don't need to get into. But it was a factor that we had a number of years where the forecast was higher than the postseason actual actual return. And as a result, we either got real close to the allowable ESA limit and did so more quickly than we would like. And so a discussion occurred where a buffer was inserted to basically say, don't leave 30% plus, because as a result of the step process in those abundance tables, a 30% buffer generally actually results in something like a 30 to 35% reduction in allowable catch. And we probably don't have time to go into why that is, but it's a little more than 30 when you put it on the ground. That gives us room to observe less than we forecasted and still be okay on the conservation front. And it does so regardless of what the driver for that difference is. And so that's not specific to climate change as a standalone item, but I think it is relevant to the things we expect to see in terms of conservative management. Other examples, I struggle to think of too many others where there's a direct and explicit buffer process built in, but I know we have where we have concerns about, I'll give you another example here, where we have concerns about these kind of steps. So if we have a forecast that says Snake River Wild Abundance is going to be 8,000 and we're at 11.25%, I think, at that rate. And if that drop, and if we catch 11.25% of the run in the fisheries and then the forecast drops to 8.25%, to a scale that puts it at 8.25, we will be over our ESA impacts. We will have killed too many of those fish. If we see a forecast where we tend to be kind of right on the cusp of one of those drops, the 2020 example I used was relative to this stock. We were in a condition where we were right on the edge of, if the run came in, you know, not that much less than forecast, it would drop. And so we chose, the managers chose to manage at the lower rate just right out of the gate. And so that was, again, not an explicitly required buffer, but just a recognition that we were right on the edge of one of those transition points. And we wanted to be conservative, and it worked. It was a good approach. So it's a little different than your question, I think, but that's my best shot at giving you some examples.
That's helpful. That actually gets at what I was trying to ask. So thank you. The more general question I have is, and this is the one that's the follow-up, if you will, to Jim Anderson's, and that is, it's tough to make the connections between, if you're trying to get better returns, for instance, and you're managing the fishery with harvest, and you have to look at habitat as well. It's easier just to do one, of course, but with cold water refugia and others, you've made that connection, and more we have to look at that whole bubble of climate change and the impacts, and whether it's a habitat response or a harvest response. Is there anything that you can say about how, that, so that we can be thinking about this more, about how those connections can be made, and they were clearly with the refuges. So is there anything else you can say about how we would look at those, like with resilience, which is another huge issue? Are there ways we can be looking at that? Because it's not all going to be a harvest response. It really needs to be the whole all H's and connected. So.
And I'd open this up to some other folks who've been at this longer than me, if they want to jump in or deeper in some of these processes. But I think one of the obvious ones would be recovery plans, the recovery planning processes, updates to those recovery plans. Those are the places where the 4-H really do come to the fore, 4-H's, and get incorporated into sort of the future planning. And then when those get updated, and most of them that have been done, any of them within the last 15 to 20 years that I'm aware of, and again, it's really not my area of expertise, but most of those, if not all of them, already have at least some recognition of climate change as a factor. Now, that would obviously, we learn more every year about it. So when you update, that may change a little bit. But those are one key place that I think that nexus occurs, at least relative to the 4-H's, including harvest. There may be others. That's the most immediate one that comes to mind.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Zarnowitz.
Mine isn't so much questions, although everybody's asked good questions that helped clarify things. But I do want to say, Chris, that this was a very good presentation that really integrated as much as possible things I wondered about when fisheries are being examined for harvest or conservation or other things. So I appreciate it, and you did a great job. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll also add thanks to Chris for an outstanding presentation. Chris, it reminds me of why you were known as such a very strong performer in the Pacific Council arena, carrying the ball for Oregon. And it's just another great piece of work on your part. It's good to see that you list things like the annual State of the Ecosystem report that comes around every year, and we can hear how things are going from the sand fleas all the way up to the killer whales. It's good to see in here where you talk about how the forecasts can be adjusted each year for what the current oceanographic conditions are, or if you're using JAKS as a forecast, they carry with them what are the impacts of ocean acidification on zooplankton and all the rest of these questions. So As usual, when we start to hear about this, we find out the staff is way ahead of everybody. They're thinking about all these things in advance. They're constantly seeking improvements in all this. And for us at the commission level, it becomes a question of what do we want to put in as commission policy to ensure that this gets considered appropriately. So if we do get down the road to a joint policy agreement, like we've got on had on sturgeon and what we're hoping for here, what would we put in such a document to ensure that the commission will on incorporating what I guess Commissioner Anderson said, the broad stuff about climate change and how do we, and someone here said building things into our understanding grows. So what kind of policy language do we put in there so it is strong direction from both commissions that as you look to manage these Columbia River salmon runs, that climate change is all going to be a distinct part of the action? And so this gets us off the launching pad a little bit on that. The policy language stuff is always tough to come up with. But anyway, thanks again for a great presentation. Someone asked, can we get a copy of this later? I think for all the presentations here today, if they were listed on our website under the agenda or on the ODFW website when they report the results of this so that people can go back and look at all these presentations, that's going to put us further down the road to where we hope to go. But anyway, great presentation. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. And I will be sending a copy of this along to the coordinator shortly.
Okay, Jim, I think you got the, it appears, the last comment. Commissioner Anderson.
Well, it was a little bit directed and not necessarily conclusive, but maybe Chris can answer this or tell me that he already answered it. But I guess the extent to which our exploitation rates that are used, that were developed by NOAA, you know, firmed through the USV Oregon and the like, driven by an understanding of environmental concerns. So what I know NOAA does that. It's part of recovery plans and the biological opinion and all that. At that point, I start to get confused. But you know, I guess I'm trying to understand to what extent we've got a framework within that we're already using that takes into account environmental conditions.
I can take a shot at it. One quick response would be that, you know, as I tried to allude to, probably not very well, I know most of these recovery plans, if not all of them, have a climate change recognition built into them. There could be some that are old enough that they don't, but I really don't think that's the case because they get updated. So the question then becomes, you know, what changes relative to expectations for climate change down the road? So that's one. And the other is really goes back to the abundance-based framework for so many of these stocks in that it is intended to and is responsive to declines in abundance. That we will see under those scenarios. So that's another one, whether it's directly in there as a climate change only measure, it's really not, but it certainly is in response to any of the things that would drive a population one direction or another, up to and including climate change, as well as, you know, any of the other things as well. So I don't know if that helps.
I think so. So you did kind of cover it. I guess one of my thoughts is that in our structure of seasons and the like, we tried to move towards an abundance-based approach, albeit in the context of harvest, but it does get at the issue of run strength and kind of a framework.
Thank you, Commissioner Anderson. Okay, if there are no other questions on the climate change presentation by Chris Kern, that was very well done and created a number of good questions, Chris. Thank you again in advance. We will go to next steps. And it looks like we've got about 45 minutes left to go through the final part of our agenda. I think that's adequate time. Next steps, who would like to start that off from either Oregon or Washington. Vice Chair Baker, please. Need to unmute yourself, Barbara.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. I have a few things to say about this, and I just want to start by saying that I'm not sure everybody's going to agree with them. So if you don't agree with them, that's part of the conversation. They're also very general. But I've been working hard, not only to get up to speed on fish everything, but to think about how this negotiation can be productive and how to keep it going until we get to a conclusion that we actually not only all get drugged to, but we're enthusiastic about. So I wanted to say that I certainly appreciate the initial comments by everybody that talked about that I appreciate the willingness to participate. And it's nice that we're committed to this process. And we understand that, you know, we, the Oregon Commission, are asking you, the Washington Commission, are asking the Oregon Commission to rethink a current policy. And so I think we really appreciate the willingness to get on these long meetings and to go through it. I heard a few things that just as we went through this couple of hours that we may need to get back to, just to list those quickly. I think Oregon was concerned that they would like to see the status of the fish runs segmented into wild and aggregate so that we have the wild fish runs at our next meeting possibly, and the status of those. I also heard Chair Wall say at the beginning that if and when Oregon changes its policy regarding Columbia River, they're going to go through an extensive process. They're going to start with the commission process, which I guess is this, and then go to the public and then go to rulemaking. And so that made me think, well, this isn't going to be a short-term negotiation. And maybe at some point we ought to come back and kind of discuss a schedule and think about how long those things will take and whether any of the experience that Washington has gone through in the last 3 years actually can help shorten that or not. Again, no right answer to that. I was very heartened to hear the discussion about that our goals are similar, and there's some promising negotiating things that we could do with setting out our goals, perhaps taking the goals that Don alluded to out of our policy and looking at Oregon's goals and starting to build a framework which will hopefully end in concurrent policy. The alternative gear was a good discussion. I have a lot to say about alternative gear, but it is something that's been in our policy, I think both of them, since 2012. And if we failed at anything, it is to develop alternative gear that is effective and works for the commercial fishery. So it's real important to me that we continue on with that. And then climate change, again, I'll just say that was a great presentation. So what I'd like to do is just cut to the chase a little bit and wrap up my thoughts on this by saying that I think we're still talking past each other to some extent. And until we either agree or discuss the issues that we're talking past each other, it's going to be hard to agree on a concurrent policy. So I tried to write down what I thought our respective positions on this are, and here's what I put. I put for Washington Fish and Wildlife, we changed our policy after an extensive year-long review based on the outcomes of our 2012 policy change. And our changes addressed the failures of that policy and the communities that were affected by those failures. So that's what we were doing. And then we asked Oregon to concur, which is how we got here. And then what I put about Oregon, and this is where I'm really going out on a limb, but I wrote, Oregon Fish and Wildlife is reluctant to change allegations and gear in their current policy until they have a better understanding of the effect on the resource. And their objective is to increase populations and returns, especially of wild fish, which gives them a fairly conservative approach to changing their policy. So thinking about that, I think when we meet again, we need to address the 5 points that were raised during this meeting. We need to think about short-term, mid-term, and long-term solutions to this. And we sort of need to bracket how long we're going to think this is going to take. And then again, we need to start figuring out what we do agree on. And I think that we should put together a couple of comparisons of our goals, including the Oregon goals of understanding the 4-H's better, not just saying that we're gonna understand them better, but having an understanding of what we're doing, as much of a prediction of how climate change is gonna change what we're doing or how conservative we should be, which I think those buffers have a lot to say about that. And then just starting to list things that we need to talk through and hopefully add to our list of agreed upon policies. If we can do that, well, first off, it'll be amazing. But second of all, it will be a process that by the end of it, we can all agree on. So that's what I have to say. I could put that down in writing if the pieces got missed, but that's, I think, how we have the best chance of getting to concurrency. And also, I think that it would be good for us to have an in-person meeting as soon as we can, so that we aren't talking to blocks on a computer, but we're talking to each other. So that's what I have to say.
Vice Chair Baker, that was an in-depth delivery. And if you could put that into writing, I would be one that would appreciate it, because you covered a lot of items there. So any questions or response to Vice Chair Baker? Chair Wall, please.
Thank you. I have a couple. And Vice Chair Baker, I appreciate that you're giving us that and your ability to synthesize in that way. It's incredibly helpful. To one of your points, I think that we, as long as we're at the goal level and the level we were today, there is some talking past each other and either an in-person meeting or getting into some of the translations of what we all think the goals mean to what that might play out as, either as a policy or in actions, would help us stop talking past each other and actually get to where there may be some different views. We in Oregon, so that's one point. And an example of that is there are goals in the Washington policy, for instance, that say, that talk about not damaging the resource, which is terrific, or not impairing the resource. We heard extensively about the Columbia River Basin goals, and those looked at least for some of the stocks, the 2% and the 4%, and maybe looking at full sense recovery. That's different than meeting ESA, and it's different than meeting not impairing, because it looks at what's it going to take to have those stocks sustained into the future. And that's an area where on the goals, we could look at, in the Columbia River Basin group did a great deal of base work for us. We could look at those goals and see if those work for us. And I think that would be something to really consider, and it would save us enormous amounts of time if we can look at their goals and find those at least as our base. I don't think that it has to take a great deal of time for Oregon to go to its rules and that sort of thing. But I think the distinction that's important for us to remember is we're talking about the policy for how we operate the fishery, or we're talking about the policy, so for allocation and gear type. And that's where we keep dropping back to. And we're not, you know, we have said we would like that conversation to be in the context of what's the status of the resource and what can we do to improve the runs. So it's not a matter of Oregon being reluctant to open rules. It's a matter of putting the first obligation first, which is let's talk about the resource and conserving the resource and knowing what the status of those wild stocks are and what we can do to improve them, and then talk about the allocation and gear types and those sorts of things in that context. And that's where I think we've been, you know, we've been fairly consistent in that's our interest. And hopefully that makes some sense to you. And I've heard several things today that make it sound like that does make sense. So I just wanted to put those on the table.
Thank you, Chair Wall. I think that could conclude next steps, because A is 2021 scheduling and in-person meeting ? And then B is the next meeting agenda, which I have three items to bring up, and I'm sure people have others, including updates on subject matter topic from the 2021 meeting and climate change. So anyone have any comments on moving forward in that direction? Commissioner McIsaac. Unmute yourself, Don, please.
There we go. How many hundreds of times do we have to learn that? Or at least I do.
Twice.
Now that I've spoken long enough, I'll get unstable internet and it'll all go away. I think you've got a good handle on it there. The one little practical matter is in the context of having some more meetings to get to these endpoints and having one in person if we can. It'd be nice if we could ask the staff to look over the course of 2021 and maybe pick four dates or pick some number of dates. And wrestling with exact dates is very difficult to get things that stick. But as part of the assignment would be, I think, to if people are willing to do this, is to log in some dates through the rest of the year. We don't have to talk for sure what is the exact end point of all those meetings. That can develop as we move through, but I think it would go along with what's been described here by yourself and Commissioner Baker and Chair Wall. So I think that's all there. But I think one thing we would like to have is a date for our next meeting and a calendar that gets to addressing these issues over the course of 2021 to some degree of comfort level from both commissions.
Thank you, Commissioner McKay. Okay, I'll bring forward a discussion that Chair Wall and I had and her recommendation for the next meeting, which does seem to fit with mine and perhaps ours, May 26th. So I'll just throw that out and we can, that's prior to the Memorial Day weekend. So we can go from there. While other people are thinking of other dates, and I don't think we're going to be able to get other dates done today. I don't think that's possible. The next meeting agenda and what we're going to have on that, I think, is an important place to spend a few minutes. Anyone have any initial comments? I have a couple to add or throw out for consideration.
Why don't you go ahead with those and we're organizing our thoughts.
Okay. The economic argument, which is, I don't want to get into details today, but just trying to figure out a way that we can help the fishing industry, and the fishing industry in our mind and in our state includes the commercial and the recreational. They're both important, and I know that's the same in Oregon. I would like to see a briefing with the appropriate science and data to back it up of the release mortality rates that are being used or considered to be used on both the sport and the commercial industries. The next one I have is, we did talk about just briefly, I think. I've had so many meetings, I sometimes lose track of what meeting was what, but I would like to get a bi-state discussion going on where we are on the buyback issue. And the last one, we've all talked about alternative selective commercial gear, i.e. the status of pound net and any other gear that might be being contemplated by staff or commission members. That's the three that I had, Chair Wall.
Thank you. So say the release mortalities, the buybacks, and what was the third one?
The alternative selective year discussion, pound net, either with piling driven or anchored, or what other ideas might be out there, just to kind of get that topic on the table going forward to try and find some improved selectivity for the commercial industry. Vice Chair Baker, I see your hand is up.
So Larry, are you talking on the release mortalities? Are you thinking about asking staff to look at most the best numbers we have and then going through each gear type and talking about which fish survived being caught and let go, or is it something else?
No, that's it. What I heard earlier, what I was not, I didn't buy into, and I want to get a precise overview of the release mortalities because of the selective nature of the fisheries that we are moving towards. Does that answer your question, Barbara?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Chair Wall.
Just in terms of moving forward and figuring out the next meeting and whether or not the 26th of May is a good date or not, but if we could think about it, what we had going into this meeting at one time, and would we had decided to move that out to our next one in order to have the conversation we had today, was an update on and recap of the SARS presentation, the four state presentation, and the collaborative efforts. I think they could be much shorter than they were before, but it would be useful to get that recap, perhaps a recap of the climate change discussion. And then we've heard from several commissioners that they would like to talk about actions and what of the actions that we all might be considering would even be in our wheelhouse and that we could influence. It's probably too late or too early to have that third conversation with any kind of specificity, but I'd like to at least think about getting some actions that people are thinking about, they're in their heads, and have a no-fault conversation and get some of those on the table, perhaps not have conclusions, but get them on the table so that we have the information out there. And I wonder, with those things coming forward from the last meeting and the ones that you have mentioned, if we might get maybe we should get the two chairs and the two vice chairs together soon, not wait till May, but like in the next week, mm-hmm. and talk about what a proposed agenda could be so that we can give some specifics to people. And then today, if we could just finish hearing from the other commissioners, if there are specifics that aren't already on this list.
I would like to ask Nikki. Nikki, you are on here, are you not?
Yes, I am.
Were you able to record all those items that were mentioned by several of us?
A good chunk, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
I was trying to scratch them out, but I couldn't write fast enough. My shorthand isn't. So, okay. Other commissioners, Commissioner McKaysey. Unmute yourself, Don.
Okay. There's the 101st time today.
Nice to hear from you again.
So, in terms of some ideas for agenda business and then maybe another discussion of timing. The status of the runs, as I was mentioned, hatchery wild splits for the big mega graphs that we've already looked at, and maybe incorporating into that a little discussion of what does it take to improve the wild runs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So for example, we have Upper Columbia River Spring Chinook, a wild run that's not doing very well. And it has a pretty minor fishery impact. And so its status to start with and its ability not to recover as hoped for is not related to fishing, obviously, if you have a 2% take on them. And so you have to look at habitat and you have to look at hydro and to whatever extent you have to look at hatchery impacts there. So when we look at these wild runs, and we see some that are going to need some attention, I think it's good for the staff to come forward and say, what's the cause of the problem here? That's where the source of the solution is going to be. If it's a heavily fished run, then fishing is going to be part of the solution. But if they could just kind of sort those out and get to some of the, that's a question that the Chair Wall put forward. And so that's one thing. The matter of a side-by-side showing of policy goals or policy things that Vice Chair Baker brought up. I think that is a very good agenda item to have on there. And that would be a continuing agenda item as we move through time. But she mentioned a comparison side-by-side with whatever the stated Oregon goals are. And if we just went down through our policy and split the page in half and looked at what Oregon's current things are to see that what I think will show a lot more commonality than my little yellow highlighting, that I think will keep us going. The third thing I'd mention is the matter of not just May 26th. And I think before I can protect that particular date, but we need to make sure that the staff is going to be okay to come forward with what we've asked by then, but also picking some more dates than just one. And whether that happens between now and May 26th, a recommended schedule. But I think what I heard Vice Chair Baker talk about is a sequence of meetings over the course of the year that's dedicated to a final situation whereby we have better policy and regulatory concurrency. We keep that in mind. So those are the three things I'd bring up. And I know I see a little red recording button here if Nikki doesn't get them all, but I'll be glad to send mine in too.
I think we've got probably enough agenda items now for a couple meetings, but I do think they're all very important. And I think continuing on with these status reviews and updates, I think are very, very important. Commissioner Anderson.
Yeah, exactly. Larry, I think we just laid out what could be a couple days of agenda. So I think the most important thing for me is that the encouragement to keep the discussion going. I don't think we've wrestled things down to the ground yet to determine where the real priorities are. I think we still have people wanting to get more information, getting it out there on the table. And then I think we need to develop a better sense of priorities at the next session. I definitely think that we need to get schedule out some other meetings, not necessarily today, but if we want to keep this thing moving, which I think we do.
I definitely think we do. And comment on that. Chair Wall suggested that the two chairs and the two vice chairs, Greg Woolley and Barbara Baker, get together and talk about this. I think we could come up within the next week or 10 days with three or four dates to put out into the future, to put out for consideration and adoption. I think we should do that. And I think we can do that, Jim.
Okay.
Anyone else? Commissioner Zarnowitz.
I think I sounded like you were going to work together with the two chairs and the two vice chairs to put a agenda together. To me, just off the top of my head, seems that the last things that Vice Chair Baker mentioned and that Commissioner McIsaac mentioned again seem to me like something to follow up on at the next meeting, since we've gone through some of this, at least the Washington policies and some of the other aspects, such as the economic reasoning behind the Washington policies, as a follow up with additional information about some of the other details that you mentioned, Chair, about the about the buyback and the alternative gear and the four state commissions. That's, I guess that's just what I kind of vote for at this point.
Very good. Thank you, Commissioner Zarnowitz. Vice Chair Woolley, please.
Okay, thanks. So I agree we have a really robust list that'll take us through at least a couple of meetings. So I don't have anything specific to add to that, maybe just to emphasize and kind of a follow-up to Commissioner Isaac, to take a closer look at habitat conditions as a variable to impacting run success, specifically spawning success. I feel that's really important. And then also just to keep in mind that as we go along, and I know the Washington Commission is very conscious of this, you know, we're not simply a presentation and discussion group. I mean, there are some goals, and we're projecting out through the year, but I think we need to just be conscious of the fact that we need to get somewhere, and then we do need to get to concurrency. And at some point, we may decide, well, it's just great to, even when we get to that, that we should just continue to talk and communicate, and that's fine, too. But, you know, I'm involved with a couple of committees, you know, with our commission on some other issues. And I'm just really trying to be conscious of the fact that we have an endpoint, and, you know, and then we don't want to just go ad nauseum if we have some goals at the end to reach. So thanks.
Thank you, Vice Chair Woolley, well stated. Any other comments from any of the commission members? Seeing none, would either director like to comment in any way, shape, or form, or are you going to stay on the sideline?
I think the sidelines look pretty good. Honestly. I think you definitely have plenty of agenda material, and I think we can deliver on those.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Director Susawind and Director Melcher. I think it's important that you folks are here. We need your leadership and your participation in some difficult fact-finding and details here. So thank you for that. I don't have anything else. Chair Wall, I'm going to move to adjourn unless you have a closing statement.
I would never be between us and declaring victory by adjourning
early. So. I don't know about victory, but thanks to everyone for what I thought was an outstanding meeting. A lot of information shared. I'll leave it at that. Everybody be safe and have a nice day.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Bye-bye.